For over 30 years, Littleton has been helping people just like you sell their coins and currency. Whether you're an experienced collector or someone who needs help identifying what you have in your collection, Littleton Coin Company is a place to sell your U.S. coins and currency. The process is incredibly simple. Visit littlecoin.com/majority to learn more. Visit littlecoin.com/majority to learn more.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, August 25th, 2017. My name is Michael Brooks on a Michael Friday, and this is the four-time winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Cliff Schechter joins me to discuss Donald Trump cutting bait, a possible Republican civil war, and Roger Stone warning of blood on the streets and an actual civil war if Trump is impeached. Plus, voting systems heading into 2018 are still vulnerable to every type of manipulation you could imagine. This is a bigger story than Russia or not Russia, everybody. This is about election integrity across the board. And film guy Matthew Weiss will join us to recommend a movie to... wonder what else Matthew will have on his mind. He'll probably have some new spiritual tips, maybe. Cultural insight.
Merchandise.
There is a really dangerous storm headed, I believe, to Texas. We'll be monitoring that as well. This could be the first sort of major FEMA crisis of a Trump administration. You can imagine the incompetence and casual racism that characterized the Bush administration's response to Katrina. One can only imagine the levels of incompetence and racism that will characterize this crew. Bob Corker called Trump, questioned his stability. It took him a week to hit him back, but Donald Trump did just that, questioning...
Counterpuncher.
I never punch first. Questioning Bob Corker's stability. Shocker.
He's sick.
Sick. Totally unfair and a bad guy. All that. And then, of course, in the fun half, your calls and IMs on today's Majority Report. Let's do this Corker stuff up front. So this is from, when was this? It was about a week, last Friday. Bob Corker, who's a very conservative senator in Tennessee, was approached by AP reporters. And I think we'll talk about this more with Cliff, but this is the kind of wheels coming off. There's been stages of Republican delusion about Donald Trump. And so first was that somehow he wouldn't be a front runner in a Republican primary, which is crazy because, yes, I mean, my God, Republican base would, of course, be totally repulsed by a message of xenophobia and racism.
Racist billionaire?
Yeah, wait. Every single thing that this party has rewarded and forwarded for decades would somehow be, offensive to...
It's objectified in my body.
It's literally who I am. I am the worst of everything in one vehicle. And then, of course, he won. Moving forward, then clearly they had this plan going in, which is like, look, Pence will run the show. He'll be babysat. We'll fly him around. We'll tell him he's president. He'll get to play with all the big toys. And then we'll get rid of health care, destroy the environment, get rid of financial deregulation, maybe escalate some wars. They have been escalating some wars, and give away money to rich people, and he can just sort of be president. That's obviously not working, because, well, Bob Corker might have some insight about this. They're asking Bob Corker, and Senator Corker had some thoughts about Trump's stability.
The president has not yet been able to demonstrate the stability nor some of the confidence that he needs to demonstrate in order to be successful. And we need for him to be successful. Our nation needs for him to be successful. It doesn't matter whether you're Republican or Democrat. We need for our president. The world needs our president to be successful.
Actually, quite the opposite. It's the sort of bizarre saving grace in some ways of the time we're living in is Trump's lack of stability and competence. And shockingly, Donald Trump, it took him, how long was this? It took him about a week.
A full week
to counterpunch. I would imagine. I don't think that General Kelly actually takes the phone literally out of Trump's hands, but the amount of trinkets they had to put in front of him, the amount of distractions, the amount of, like, I wonder what they tell him, like, when he's about to do a Bob Corker tweet. Like, I heard that, that
Jesse Waters said ESPN's really stupid these days, and you need to see this right away.
Well, yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah. ESPN is totally with Barack and against me, and it's unfair. Well, Donald Trump did finally respond as of this morning. Strange statement by Bob Corker, considering that he's constantly asking me whether or not he should run again in 18. Tennessee, not happy. And this remains the most bizarre thing about Donald Trump, because it's like, this is truly what he is best at. He's not good at real estate. He's not good at casinos. His businesses have been bankrupted. His daddy needed to fund him. His daddy needed to bail him out. He, I guess he's good at all. He's also good at reality TV. And apparently he's good at doing fake scam university. But the true gift that Donald Trump has is not for business. It's not for entrepreneurship. It's not for certainly any type of political leadership. But he owned Republicans so well during the primary. He decimated these horrible mediocrities, Lindsey Graham, Marco Rubio, Jeb Bush, one after the other. And now I wonder when this article, this is from the vetting process, so this wasn't recently re-leaked. But apparently Bob Corker was on Donald Trump's list. He was under consideration for VP.
And Secretary of State.
This was for Secretary of State. I had actually think that Bob Corker was floated, I think also briefly for VP. This was during the transition. Corker, who does sit on the Foreign Relations Committee, was also considered for Secretary of State. Trump had a lot of fun with this process. You remember that picture in the Manhattan restaurant of Mitt Romney looking like,
Hello,
this is Mitt Romney. I'm being tortured and emasculated in real time. But apparently Bob Corker was on that, was not tall enough to make it on Trump's short list. And this is a piece, this is from USA Today. I'll read from it. Jack McElroy reported that U.S. Senator Bob Corker lists his height as 5'7". I think that's wishful thinking. My growth spurt, such as it was, topped out at just below 5'4". I've lost altitude since then. Still, anytime I've shaken hands with Corker, we're pretty much eye to eye in height, if not in policy. So it wasn't a huge surprise for me that when the Daily Caller reported last week that Corker's diminutive stature helped disqualify him for the Secretary of State's job. So
See, I just think you're not tall enough to be Secretary of State, so take that.
I don't think you're tall enough. Maybe in a certain sense, you're not tall enough to be a senator. Is there, like, anything that Donald Trump does? Like, we can go through history of, like, all of the great people in history who would just be immediately disqualified. I mean, obviously, because, you know, Cesar Chavez was Mexican. MLK was black. But then we're also going to start getting into, like, disqualified. But, like, FDR was in a wheelchair. Could he really negotiate? Like, in a certain sense, wasn't he the one that maybe we would have won World War II faster? Like, is that the thought
process? Hard to know how Trump would use that, actually. Like, what do you say? And maybe he would have lived out his final term.
Maybe he would have lived out. A lot of people would have liked him to live out his final term. I would have liked him to have been tougher.
And I'm definitely going to live out mine. And
how does it all end, Matt? We have a couple more minutes before we get to Cliff. How does this all end?
Well, I have predicted that he was going to resign. When I remember, like, in January, I have the group chat to prove it, that right. I don't think he would be there in a year, which I think it's wishful thinking. But if I have to plant my flag down anywhere, I want to be on the wishful side of things. So
he's out in a year. And then is it Pence in 2020?
As the nominee?
Mm-hmm.
No, I don't think they'll run Pence as a general election candidate.
Because Pence is so toxified and unpopular to begin with. So who do the Republicans go with if we're in this fantasy scenario?
It's not going to be Flake Jeff Flake.
No, Flaky Jeff is not running.
I could see maybe a Kasich thing. I don't know. It's hard to say because it's hard to know how Trump. If Trump
it's
is
still
removed,
the Trump
right?
party.
Like, yeah,
it can't
exactly.
be Kasich. Kasich has shown a glimmer of sort of indirect human decency, and that's not going
to
work.
Well, I that's why I think it's hard to say. It's hard to say because who knows what exactly will happen if Trump is removed from office. Like, if it's a complete meltdown of the party, it's all contingent on that, I feel like. Because a lot of this, I think a lot of where people come down on after that is going to be different than where you'd expect.
Right. Hey, thanks everybody for 577 people on Patreon for the Michael Brooks Show. Usually we're Tuesday night live, but tonight, since we're on vacation next week, tonight at 6 p.m. live, Nation of Islam Obama is launching a late night TV show. We have that. Right Wing Mandela has interviewed Andy Kindler for his radio show. And Brianna Joy Gray is going to be with me in studio to talk about her piece in Current Affairs on sort of knockoff intersectionality, undermining left arguments, that and a whole lot more. Thanks, everybody, for making that happen. I think now we can get Cliff. So let's take a brief break, and we will be right back with Cliffy Cliff Schechter on the Majority Report. Back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Cliffy Cliff Schechter. Cliff, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good, man. So, yeah, well, excuse me. You know what, Cliff? I should confess, I'm totally exhausted, and that's song. Why. And that's why I'm just about to get to it. That's why I made the mistake.
I thought maybe you played it before I came on. You know, I wasn't sure.
My apologies. Before we talk to Cliff, we have to stick to tradition, and we have to play. It's not only is it a great sort of primer on Cliff, it's actually a kind of good sort of public disclosure of any possible conflicts of interest that Cliff might have in the following conversation.
That's why I like to do it.
Yeah, so without further ado, the Cliff Schecter theme song.
Cliff Schecter, Libertas LLC, New Media, Public Relations, and Strategy. You want any of these services, you know who you gotta see. Cliff Schecter, LibertasLLC.com.
I like .com. That's my favorite part, the fade out. .com.
You got to get that in there, you know? I mean, otherwise, who knows where you're going to find me?
That's right. We can also find you on Twitter. Cliff, it's really fun to have you in studio, man. We got to get you in studio someday when I'm hosting.
That's right. Well, we'll figure that out. Yeah. I think in the last year I've been there twice. We can probably up that a few times.
Yeah, it sounds good.
You know, get rowdy. Maybe I won't even bring the kids next time. Who knows what'll happen?
Yeah, if you could not bring your children, because I usually would like to use more profanity when you're on air, that would be great.
Dude, you couldn't use any more profanity than I use in front of them around the house. So I think you're okay.
All right, so good. So really quick, Cliff, we're about to get to this Roger Stone sound, but do you have a podcast update for anybody, for everybody?
I do. Absolutely. Thank you. Yes, we're on. We've got about five of them out there now. They're all free content at this point. iTunes, you can find it. Unprecedentedpodcast.com. Unprecedented. And, you know, what Genius Donnie tweeted out that time.
Yep.
And that'll take you to our iTunes, and then that is the most important thing. And go listen. You need to put up ratings. Give us as many stars as it'll allow you to do, so people will think we are, you know, they'll be like, whoa, that is a hot podcast right
there. It's a
hot
topic.
And that's right. We need that, folks. So please go do that. And then, you know, for the low, low price of $5 a month, you can also get the paid content at Patreon, which is going to start soon. And we're going to have some damn sexy stuff in there, folks. I got to tell you.
Sounds good, man.
As Trump would say, I got to tell you.
You're the one who's unprecedented.
Yeah,
You're the one. So, Cliff, we're going to get to how Donald Trump is starting to distance himself from the GOP. And I've been saying, you know, for a while that, it's very important to always remember that this breakup, if it's happening, and it's not really happening, but this skirmish is happening not because of any ethics or conscience on the part of Mitch McConnell or Paul Ryan. It's because the plan isn't working. But
you're funny because you said ethics and then you said McConnell and Ryan.
Yeah, exactly. You don't even need a tag on that joke. So Roger Stone, they caught up with Roger Stone. And Roger Stone is, you know, one of the only people, in addition to being sort of, you know, extravagantly kind of like professionally deeply unethical and at least overt about it. He is, you know, this is the Donald Trump sort of brainstem. This is the Donald Trump mind. I mean, you look at Alex Jones or Roger Stone to know what's happening. And so you have,
you know, what
move,
else he is though?
Yeah. What
too,
else is
which
he?
Is really, I don't mean to interrupt you, but
ahead.
This is a meta kind of thing.
Yeah.
He is, if for those here who ever watched the X-Files,
right.
He's the smoking guy.
I've never watched it. What's the smoking guy?
You go to any... basically, he's the guy who shows up at every sort of conspiracy, like when JFK is killed, anything bad that happens,
right.
There's a guy there who kind of... That's Roger Stone. He's like the Forrest Gump of crappy stuff in U.S. history since Nixon. Basically,
right.
You know, I mean, right. He's with Nixon for Watergate. He was in the Reagan shop. You know, Iran-Contra eventually grows out of that. He brags about having played a role in the Brooks Brothers riot that helped them stop counting the votes so George W. Bush became president in 2000. He's now Trump's hatchet man. So he's done work
for Trump, I think, off and on since the 80s, going back for just sort of helping, you know, shill for Trump's, you know, casinos and various scams that he was up to in the 80s. And those, of course, are all, you know, and also Roger Stone has a Roy Cohn connection as well. So, I mean, this is
that's
this
right.
sleazy,
if there's
grotesque,
a new We Didn't Start the Fire by Billy Joel, he will have to show up in there.
Exactly.
He's been, if there's an ugly, ugly event in U.S. history politically at any time in the last sort of 40 years, he's probably been pretty close to it. And
this is it. You get a taste of how he operates right here, because Donald Trump is distancing himself from Republicans. We'll get to that in a second. But here's the Roger Stone version from the operative Alex Jones, which is the Republican base, or a significant part of the Republican base side, of a shot across the bow to, you know, don't press Donnie. TMZ caught up with him. I don't know what airport this is. LAX. And this is what Roger Stone had to say.
Even calling for like impeachment already and that sort of stuff. Do you think there's any chance that he might be impeached?
The people who are calling for impeachment are the people who didn't vote for him. They need to get over it. They lost. The candidate had every advantage. She spent $2 billion. He spent $275 billion. Sorry, he whipped her ass. It's over. You lost. Try to impeach him. Just try it. You will have a spasm of violence in this country, an insurrection like you've never seen.
You think?
No question.
You think if he got impeached, like the country
both
would go
both sides are heavily armed, my friend. Yes, absolutely. This is not 1974. The people will not stand for impeachment. A politician who votes for it would be endangering their own life. There will be violence on both sides. I'll make this clear. I'm not advocating violence, but I'm predicting it.
You're predicting that if he got impeached, there'd be some sort of civil war type.
Yes, I do. That's what I think will happen.
So, you know, I think obviously that's framed at Democrats, but I think that, you know, it just as easily could be turned on the Republican leadership if they get out of line rhetorically. Remember, they're not going to actually
or
do
really
anything.
Any Republican, you know, who's willing to vote for it, he's threatening. And again,
or I think even speak against him, not even vote for it. Yeah.
Right. Well, and remember the context of all of this, too. I mean, of course, he's not advocating it.
Right.
He's just, you know, here he is, you know, what are we now? 2 weeks since the events in Charlottesville?
Yep.
You know, where an innocent woman is murdered because of a lunatic right winger egged on by Trump and the gang.
Yep.
And the gang, quite literally. And, you know, and after that, and, you know, I've certainly been on this show enough times talking about how easily we've made it for all, every lunatic to get their hands on assault weapons and other, you know, weapons, which he's right. Nobody had access to that kind of weaponry in 1974. I like how he brought that up. Maybe Nixon wouldn't have been impeached, and clearly he thought that was wrong. Had it been a different situation, and in a way, this is what been the exercise of far right groups and the NRA, because they've always been about bullets over ballots. So,
right.
You know, you've got an armed group of people who are not all there and are being egged on by people by Roger Stone. What could go wrong? I don't know. You know, I'm a big believer in the First Amendment, obviously. But at what point are you – I do wonder – I talk about this a lot these days. At what point are you inciting riot? You know, at what point – I guess he gets away with it because he said, I'm not advocating it.
I mean, he's all about it. Right. I mean, he's strictly within – my view is that when you do, even if it's totally disingenuous, he definitely carved enough space for himself where you can't – I mean – that speech you can't do anything about that speech, and I wouldn't. But I do think that it's very – you know,
we can hold him accountable.
We can hold him accountable, and we can also be really clear that, you know, look, there's this also runs parallel with this fantasy or this theory that, you know, Bannon is going to go back to Breitbart and go to war against Trump. And I noticed that they kind of wrapped his knuckles a little bit in Afghanistan as if they, you know, I mean, certainly they have they could care less about all the civilian casualties we caused there. And then in addition to that, Bannon was not even a non-interventionist on Afghanistan. Bannon just wanted to outsource an occupation to Blackwater, which is, you know, so kind of comically kind of, you know, neo-colonial that even the sort of present military-industrial complex, you know, laughed that idea out of the room. And obviously just a sort of pure grift for Eric Prince and other people that Bannon is close to. But I think that, you know, the reason I connected with Roger Stone is I still think that this media apparatus, whether it's Jones or Breitbart or Stone, and let's also include a lot of Fox News in this, they're still at a point where they might, you know, they might drill into, you know, Jared and Ivanka, who are terrible people and I have no sympathy for, but they'll play the anti-Semitism angles on that. And they'll
Absolutely.
Say that, you know, there's a Democratic thing in the White House. But I still see no indication that this overall, like, that swamp is going to turn on Donald Trump. I mean, maybe they will, but I think that the base still is a total mind meld with him, and those media outlets are still a conduit for him. And the next phase of it is to threaten and insinuate and, you know, get back to it. Just like, by the way, they did before the Republican convention, when they were like, look, if you try to take this away from us, there were plenty of sort of, you know, indirect and not so indirect threats, just like Stone was kind of predicting or saying will happen. He wouldn't advocate, but it will happen there as well.
No, I mean, that is exactly right. Again, you know, I mean, one of the few saving graces so far of this group of people is they've proven incompetence at causing nearly as much mayhem and trouble as they want to. And at the same time, also, I guess, even the infighting among so many of them, who in their own ways are often pure evil, is also something that has prevented them from being able to cause as much damage as they potentially could. But there should be no, you know, people shouldn't ever kind of wonder if they would and what they would like to see happen. And with, you know, with Bannon rejoining Breitbart and working with some of these far right groups he works with, I think we can expect to see him, you know, this all play out in terms of the rhetoric that they're going to use. There's no doubt Kushner, I mean, you already saw it in some of those neo-Nazi videos, right, with him targeting, in a way, saying, well, Kushner, I mean, you know, they've Jewified Donald Trump's grandchildren, and, you know,
right.
But Gary Cohn, who just spoke out, and believe me, I don't have sympathy for him either. I don't have sympathy for anybody who's stuck with
that. Yeah, Gary Cohn leaked that he was appalled by the pro-Nazi comments that Trump made. But, I mean, Gary Cohn and Steve Mnuchin are, in some ways, the most disgusting people.
I find Steve Mnuchin's wife to be a really nice woman, though.
Steve Mnuchin's wife is very insightful, and she's encouraging people to sort of get beyond politics and enjoy HBO Go. And exactly. I think that's very big of her. But, I mean, Steve Mnuchin and Gary Cohn, the strategy that Sam outlined a couple weeks ago of just, you know, massive public and personal shaming in the Jewish community of those two people needs to continue. I mean, they are, and you would, and the thing is like, look at their records. I mean, you know, the foreclosure king, a Goldman banker. I mean, you would expect them to be grotesque people. But it is amazing that even on the level of, like, something that would personally implicate them in their own identity, they don't care. It's disgusting.
Right. Have you ever, I have to say, I've always enjoyed the fact, I must say, though, that Steve Bannon, who, you know, is this nationalist and anti-Semite and the whole rest of it, basically, I mean, he's made his money first at Goldman Sachs.
Right.
You know, then he went on to managing, you know, various, I think he had a hedge fund, something of that nature. But eventually, he managed various media properties as part of his fund he was involved in. And one of the things of where he's made a ton of money is that he actually invested in initially and owned a piece of Seinfeld.
Right, right. And so I think, yeah, he made some money off Seinfeld. That's
Jews,
right.
This guy who hates Jews, supposedly, is still making millions from exporting, probably beyond, aside from Woody Allen, maybe the cultural property that exports Jewish neuroses and comedy to
well,
as far
think
out in
about
the world
it.
As possible.
Think about it. I mean, I actually did a bit. I don't even remember at which point which show it was on, but I did a bit about Bannon actually being on writing staff with Larry David and Seinfeld and injecting, you know, just like, yeah, what about there's another one where the friggin' Jews go on a no jerk off contest, you know? And like David and Seinfeld liking the concepts, but needing to tone them down a little bit. I mean, I don't know. I wonder, what is that joke in Curb Your Enthusiasm where Larry David introduces somebody to his cousin as the cause of anti Semitism? It's like, my cousin is the cause of anti-Semitism. I don't know if those shows are doing. Maybe that's Bannon's most genius stroke. Because it'd be like, if I could convince the world that all Jews were like Jerry Seinfeld, then we have another chance.
That's true. Maybe that's what he's up to.
Yeah.
I
also think that, you know, people like Bannon, they sort of, you know, they're part of these class of, you know, they would consider themselves some type of, you know, intellectual elite, and, you know, oh, I can play these games and sort of use these things instrumentally, and then we have like the moron foot soldiers. I think he very much kind of fantasizes and thinks about himself in that way. And speaking of fantasizing and sort of sense of self-perception, I mean, now that things, you know, I mean, I think especially if Menendez is removed from the Senate, then we're right back to decimating healthcare being in play. So I'm with, you know, I don't ever want to say never on that, but I do think, I mean, look, so far repealing Obamacare has failed. So far they haven't been able to put together, you know, this massive upward tax redistribution plan that they've been cooking up. So far, I mean, they've done an incredible amount of damage at the agencies and everything, and obviously the world is a, you know, significantly worse place since they've come into office. But the real kind of plan, to the extent that they had one, which is essentially just Ryanization and Koch brothers, you know, gut the social safety net plan that they had in place, a lot of it has been bottlenecked. And now Donald Trump is distancing himself from the Republicans and kind of at least getting back, I guess, after trying for a little while, you know, his initial rhetorical approach, which is that somehow he's this sort of distinct right-wing populist entity who's at war with the establishment. Obviously, it's, you know, a scam like everything else with the guy, except for the racism part. But it does seem like just as the Republicans are starting to be like, okay, we can't babysit this guy and get the agenda through for the Koch brothers and the donors, he's getting back to like, hey, you guys said that this would work, and it's not, and I'm unpopular, and I'm going to go back to my instinct of being the kind of social media ringleader, you know, hitting back Flake and Corker and everybody
else. The demagogue who will play to anybody's passions and anger and fear, and I mean, because that's what he's good at now. Is I mean, you know, he was at his best, and when I say his best, I mean in terms of how he sees himself and in terms of what he likes to do at that Phoenix rally.
Yep.
I mean, it's ground zero there for the anti-immigrant movement. Yep. You know, I spent some time there when I wrote my book on McCain back in 07, 08, and already you could see sort of the incipient kind of Tea Party, which I think grew out of a lot of that Minutemen, you know, craziness on the border there before it even made it to other parts of the country. And, you know, that is him in his element. That is him getting up and talking about our heritage in a crowd like that with Arpaio there, known, you know, well, his day job, I think, was basically just to be a racist.
Oh, absolutely.
And, you know, that's Donald Trump. And so it will be interesting because, of course, you know, it was funny, Mitch McConnell, who's ever the tactician for big capital, realized that fighting with Trump wasn't going to be good for the people that send large bribes to him to make his career work the way it does. So McConnell, of course, started apologizing, you know, and sent out, you know, sort of trying to tamp down a little bit on all those reports that he and Trump had screamed at each other on the phone, and realizing, you know, I need to get along a little bit better with the guy. I don't like him. He's nuts. But and then Trump returned the favor by insulting him, maybe in a little bit of a lesser way, a little lighter way, but insulting him again on Twitter. So, I mean, Trump just can't. People ask, is it strategy and tactics, or is it delusion? And my answer is always yes. You know what I mean? They blend into each other. I think sometimes he does think about it and say, you know, I'm at my best and I'm fighting and blah, 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 blah. But at the same time, he can't control himself either. He sits there and logically decides to pick these fights is to be wrong also. It all blends into each other. He's a mess. He always has been in everything he's done. And we should be at least, you know, it's not great foreign policy-wise, certainly, because, you know, unless you like English being brinksmanship with North Korea and the rest. But it has helped us domestically because he's not been able to do anything because he's undermined relationships with every Democrat. I mean, you know, George W. Bush, say what you want about him, had a good half a dozen to a dozen Democrats he coaxed to work with him on certain things. You know, think of a Zell Miller type. And there's no doubt.
Well, I'm sure Zell Miller would be happily working with Donald Trump.
I mean,
that guy was
in Zell Miller's defense.
Yeah, yes, yes.
In Zell Miller's defense, he's a crazy racist.
Yes, Zell Miller it's crazy because Zell Miller was part of my first sustained political exposure, you know, and I was like, how the fuck does this a guy like this become?
I mean, he was a nut, but
he was a Democrat who turned out to be a kind of arch, insane reactionary. Challenge some MSNBC host to a duel? That's like
Chris Matthews.
Right, which would have been, it would have been great to watch.
That would be if they wanted to make money. MSNBC, high ratings.
High ratings, great.
But the thing is that I think had Trump behaved differently in terms of his temperament and attacking Democrats. I mean, again, he wouldn't be Trump then. But had he done that once he got in, had he actually been able to pivot in the way that Philip Rucker so badly wants him to,
right?
then I think Joe Manchin and Heidi Heitkamp. You know, he could have potentially found those one or two Democrats to work with, but instead he's alienated every single one of them. And on top of that, a number of Republicans, you know, it's interesting how when you threaten to go after Alaska, so much so that there's an Interior Department investigation over it. Lisa Murkowski might not be inclined to work with you.
Well, and I have two quick thoughts on that. I mean, one is the smaller point with Lisa Murkowski is already several years ago, she lost the Republican primary to a totally bonkers nutcase Tea Party candidate.
Miller,
ran as an independent and she beat him in the general election. So I think she already has a little bit of – she has a confidence in her popularity in her state. She's kind of like, look, what are you going to do? You're going to do the same thing to me that happened in 2010? I'll just come back. Like, I've got a seat.
Right.
Don't try to threaten me. And she, you know, and I mean,
it's the same thing with Susan Collins.
Right.
I worked in Maine politics before, and she is a brand separate because from the Republican Party, a 70-something% approval rating, which is always to the chagrin of Democrats who can't get that down. So she's thinking of running for governor. And much like Angus King, who now caucuses with the Democrats, who was elected twice as a governor, you know, running as a sort of centristy kind of guy, Susan Collins easily could do the same thing and win enough of the vote to be elected governor of Maine. So she doesn't have to kowtow to Trump either.
Right.
And right there, you're now down to 50.
And I think
those two.
I think that's exactly right. And again, I bigger macro point, I give them almost no credit because, I mean, you know, they're very well to the right. I don't buy them as moderates, but I will always add the caveat I know you're not, but I just will say in the context of the healthcare vote, you know, McCain got all of the drama and the glory, but it was totally Collins and Murkowski who, you know, held the line and set the context for that to happen. So in that conversation, they deserve by far the most credit and kind of face down the most. And that's, you know, always important to remember. But I think, you know, the slightly bigger point is that I remember Bhaskar Sunkara and I talked about this in the transition, and we said, you know, in some ways, in addition to what you're saying about him reaching out to people, the most terrifying scenario of what Trump could have done, and I never thought it would happen because one, you know, he's not really a strategist, and two, you know, obviously there isn't a genuine commitment there. But if you had some sort of weird Bannon vision where basically they came in and they said, we're not really going to touch healthcare. We're going to, you know, propose some break up the banks type thing. We're going to do a top end tax increase, which, you know, it was a leak that Bannon supported. And we're also going to do an infrastructure project that's real, that's not just a giveaway. And look at antitrust, like objectively good, important, progressive things. And then they fuse that up with terrorizing immigrants like they already are doing, the Muslim ban, banning transgender people from military service, you would have a I actually think Bannon
would
probably not
have
wrong.
Like a 60% approval.
Yes, and I think he is not wrong when he says in some interviews that if we followed an agenda like that, we could get a significant part of African-American, Hispanic, like that. And that is where the kind of center across the board, I think, still just does not get modern politics. Because if you look at these numbers, they're incredibly encouraging from the perspective of the things that we need to do about income inequality and reigning in the corporate sector, and they still can get incredibly discouraging and disturbing when it comes to regard to things like xenophobia about immigrants, as an example. So I mean, if they had followed that, that would have been terrifying because it might have been really effective.
Well, that's, I mean, on one front, it would have been great that we would have gotten a real infrastructure and gotten a better tax system. And antitrust, I think, to me, is one of the most key issues of all is what monopolies are doing to our economy right now.
But definitely.
Taking that aside, you know, if that ended up being in service of hurting immigrants, hurting women, hurting people of color, hurting, you know, transgender, gay military, you know, gays and transgender people who want to be in the military and others. Well, you know, then that would be incredibly sad and incredibly dangerous, and
it would be fascist. It would be quite literally fascistic. I mean,
I'm trying to find the right word to say it. I mean, it would destroy the fabric of this country is what it would do, and frankly, hurt many of my friends. So, and that would piss a lot of us off who actually want an equal country. So, I agree because look, cheap demagoguery is easy. You know, I mean, our system is always sort of susceptible to that. We have a lot of institutions that push back. They have against Trump, even though some, you know, it's been like a stress test for them and some have failed. Some haven't. And that's great. But, you know, we've had our demagogues in history and they've been dangerous. And Trump could the thing is, if Trump was just a clever demagogue and not actually nuts, then this could have been a lot more worrisome, more dangerous for us.
We keep having these terrible, getting saved from even worse fates by how insane they are. Barack Obama offers a terrible deal in 2011 on Social Security and Medicare, and it doesn't pass because Tea Party people are so demented that it's not good enough. They get 70% of what they want, maybe even 80, but it needs to be 100. You know, it was like they needed Obama to say, and in addition to phasing out Social Security, I apologize for being black and I resign. And they were like, you know, and until that happens, it's not good enough for these people. And now with Trump, yes, you have the basic. I mean, I think for him, it's that he's a lunatic. And then I think structurally for Republicans, it's running up against the reality. And you saw it obviously with healthcare of like, oh, shit, now I actually literally have to vote to kill people. You know, this was fun to, you know, that, and that's the kind of other dynamic of what's going on.
But had they been willing to just damage certain unpopular aspects of Obamacare and the right hadn't been such again, as you're right, such a bunch of lunatics if they weren't willing to do it, they could have. Right. They actually really could have thrown, I mean, you get rid of that individual mandate, but you keep pre-existing conditions and suddenly healthcare companies are going to jack up premiums. Or exit exchanges, God knows what happens. But, you know, thankfully, they're too crazy to do that. So, you know, that saved us in the end. They had to go after Medicaid, which is not the popular part, or is the popular
part. That's the popular part.
The
most unambiguous, no bullshit, simple left part of Obamacare is the most popular part, which should be an enduring lesson for everybody involved in center left or left politics. So real quick, though, Cliff, I want you to talk about this. There's a new report out that you sent to me that many county election officials still lack cybersecurity training. And this is just a report by NBC News. And I just want to be clear. They're framing it, and I don't, you know, we could talk about the Russia angle for sure. But the whole issue of voter integrity and voter security predates and transcends Russia. We have a completely chaotic, messed up voting system, which fused with a national campaign on Republicans to suppress the vote of people of color and young people across the country, is an enduring. It's an erosion of democracy.
Right. And let's be honest here. It's a messed up voting system on purpose.
Right.
Because we could fix this in a second, right? If we put the proper resources and we made it a federal responsibility, which in a world where Russia can hack into our voting systems, or could China, or could ISIS, or could any, you know, number of different entities and groups, especially if we're going to keep these voting systems going, some of them in the manner in which they are going via machinery, which I don't think we should. I think we should go back to paper ballots.
Definitely.
For safety reasons.
Yes.
But if we're going to keep that, then you need to have this be under the purview of the federal government. Instead, we have purposely left it in the state in the hands of states. Well, why would we do that? Gee, I wonder. I mean, the harder it is to vote, the more one needs to access correct information and go jump through hoops. They know that the more likely the people that vote Republican are to be able to jump through those hoops and vote, you know, and then they can get away with, you know, putting the one machine in an African-American neighborhood, which they did for early voting, for example, here in Cincinnati, where some people were online for 4 hours, but can make it very different in the nice white neighborhood. So, the system as it currently is constituted allows for them to suppress many more votes than you'll ever know about, because it's not just the ones who they turn away because they don't have an ID, or, you know, because your name is the same as a name of a felon somewhere and they've got a list not allowing felons to vote, but the people who don't want to feel like waiting online for 4 hours and just leave.
Such an important point, because we get to, and I'm not even, because I think the reality is, as long as you have, I totally unaccountable and messed up voting systems. I mean, the other reality is, like, people say, like, hey, it doesn't need to be an elaborate conspiracy theory by anybody. We have a situation where practically in some cases you literally can have someone who's just like some, you know, local county chair somewhere. Is it really unbelievable to consider that maybe they might kind of mess around with voting tallies? But before we even get to that point, you know, when people say elections are stolen or rigged, you know, it sort of brings to people's minds these very elaborate kind of conspiracies. The reality is, it's already happening. Each time a African-American or Hispanic voter, or any voter that's eligible to vote, that is suppressed because of an ID law, because of the Supreme Court gutting voter, you know, civil rights and voting acts, or because of, waiting hours, to me, that is a stolen vote. That is suppressed democracy right now. It's happening in real time. The rigging is here.
And it happened in these. Beyond whatever Russia did,
yes.
Beyond what the Comey letter did, beyond people thinking that that Hillary Clinton was not an inspiring candidate, I'm sorry, you don't just lose 100,000 African American votes in Milwaukee.
No,
I mean, when you know that Scott Walker, who is the embodiment of a Koch brothers orgasm, yes, I know that was disgusting.
That is the most. Every part of that literally made me ill.
Yeah, it is ill. But Scott Walker.
I'm live. Like, I can't take a break after this to put water in my face.
He, along with John Husted, who is the Secretary of State in running for governor now of Ohio, and some of these other figures, they made this their key plan. And they did this over a number of years in power. In Scott Walker's case, he a term and a half, I guess, when this election came around. And to think that that just 100,000 more just chose not to turn out is ridiculous. And that, of course, is way beyond any margin that Trump won by. And, of course, it affects the fact that a great progressive and Russ Feingold wasn't able to be reelected. Anybody who believes that these things didn't happen and that doesn't include, people who couldn't get on voting rolls, who just walked away, they're doing it. They are rigging elections right now. And again, so to me, that's the beginning. It's the beginning of the conversation is that we're not even doing the very basics, as in training people in cybersecurity so they can stop people from hacking in. But that to me is sort of a symptom of the much broader problem here, the much broader issue, which is we're not even trying to make sure that there is an equal right to voting among various groups in this country. And it's a serious problem. And, to think after what happened in the last election that the Russians and others who saw what the Russians did, who may have similar interests or other interests, whatever, won't try to get involved in affecting our elections is just to be naive.
Hopefully China will rig it for our side in the next election. The best bet is that the Chinese are like, I think we want the Democrats back in power. I think we can override a Russian hacking program. Let's do this.
That's what we need to do. Democrats out there, if you're listening to this, as Michael Brooks is instructing you, kiss up to the Chinese government.
Team China.
Do you know what China's ancient foreign policy was called? I love this factoid. They used to call it barbarian management.
See?
And they need to manage. That was the first thing I thought of when Trump was elected. We're going to need some barbarian management, man. But Cliff, my last question, though, about this, and this just, it opens up a kind of broader point that I just want your thoughts on before we wrap up. Every time we talk about Republicans, even with all of the, you know, and there is the chink in their armor is when they actually have to govern in some ways, because so much of this is designed for opposition. But on the other hand, when you look at how, I think this is the other big problem with the sort of aimlessness of the Democratic Party, and where, why some version of an actual progressive agenda needs to be implemented, because at least it's synchronized. You know, Republicans, it works across the board. You get the donations from the Koch brothers. People are elected in office to do them favors, you know, give them tax cuts and deregulate their industries. And then you appoint people to courts that suppress Democratic voters, that then make elite, you know, that then penalize labor unions. Like it all works and mutually reinforces.
Sure.
And then with us, we've, for decades, it's like, well, we do a little bit of an investment here, but then maybe we're also anti-labor union. You know, we're going to have a party in power that implements legislation that, regardless of other specifics you get in, but even things like NAFTA or TPP, they're bad for and damaging a vital part of the vote infrastructure of our party. So even in a purely operational sense, it's not strategic and it's not coherent. And I feel, and at some point, like, Democrats need to, and that's the weird thing, because that's where, like, the kind of another problem with the technocrats is that they're off on, like, well, I don't, you know, debating the minutia of what a TPP job numbers result's going to be. And it's like, no, you're
also
hurting your whole, you know,
well, you're lacking a narrative.
Exactly.
People respond.
Yes.
You know, we tell each other, we humans, and we tell stories, and we respond emotionally to that. It doesn't mean you don't need facts. You do. You need numbers. You need facts. You need history. These things are relevant.
Right.
But we need to tell stories, and stories are told in narratives. This is who we are. This is what we're going to do for you. It's why you should vote for us. It's the other guys will do just the opposite. It's why you shouldn't vote for them. And the reason why Republicans are generally better at just blocking and not governing, I mean, part of it's because they, you know, bought into all this voodoo and none of their governing works. But also, you know, being conservative means mostly you want to block stuff from happening, whereas we want to actually make things happen to make the world a better place. And if you're going to do that, you need a coherent narrative as to why that should happen and how you're going to get it done. And there's no doubt we need to do better about that. I mean, we do.
And policy-wise, because the policy feeds the story. And I would just add, I agree with that 100%. But I think that even in some ways, because this iteration of Republicans, they're revolutionary. They don't just want to – they want to block positive things, and they actually want to do tremendous social uprooting to – if you destroy Social Security and Medicare, that is a radical thing to do. It is a complete uprooting of our social compact. So me, I'm a left, so I want, you know, I want single payer and all the rest of it. But if you were a proper paid up, you know, and this doesn't exist other, you know, in anything but people's fantasy life now, but if you were like one of these, I read Michael Oakeshott and I want to, you know, gradually change society, you wouldn't want to touch Medicare or Social Security, because those are already inbuilt parts of our social compact.
No,
so these people are revolutionaries in a certain way.
Conservative in the sense, you're right, of actually conservative, like small c conservative, would mean protecting the institutions in place and trying to gradually improve them.
Right.
It means, and that would be Social Security and Medicare, just the way it would have been that Obamacare was the conservative option.
Exactly.
To improve healthcare.
Totally.
It was to take what we had, system we had, build on that and improve it, which it did. But it wasn't like the left version. It was the center-right conservative version.
It's just undeniable. Well, Cliff,
that's not to say it didn't improve a lot of people's lives, which it did.
Yes.
And I'm happy about that. But let's move to the next phase.
Let's move to phase two. Cliff Schechter.
Phase two, baby.
Phase
Electric
two.
Bungalow.
That's right. Appreciate your time as always, buddy. Hope to talk to you plenty of places soon.
All right. Me too, buddy. Take care. Have a good weekend.
You too, man. Bye-bye. All right, everybody. We are going to – do we have a Jimmy Reefer Cake situation? No, let's play that for the fun half. We are going to come back with film guy Matthew.
That you never heard.
lobotomized.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. Joining us now is my good friend, film guy Matthew Weiss. But before he can open his mouth, you need to open your ears and listen to his song.
Matthew, the film guy, is choosing your streams. Cassavetes on Netflix and other such themes. Maybe you'll watch one and learn a few things. Please recommend me a movie to stream. Matthew, please recommend me a movie to stream. Matthew, film guy.
Oh, yeah.
Well, did you have a similar version for your bat mitzvah song?
First of all, it's bar mitzvah. I am a boy.
Bor. Bah.
At my bar mitzvah, I was more into like NXS and the Fat Boys. So I hadn't quite gotten there yet.
Fair enough. So, Matthew, what's going on, man?
You had
a birthday recently, right? And by the way, where were you? Usually I... with you on your birthday.
You usually are, but I took it low key this year. I'm back and forth in and out of town a lot this month for some corporate gigs I've been doing. So I've just decided to keep it local. Just had my lovely fiance Mary. She took me out to a nice fancy dinner, and we just kind of kept it low key. You know, it's my second 21st birthday. So
congratulations.
Thank you. I wanted to do the opposite of your usual 21st birthday bacchanalia. So I just had a good meal and we went home and watched some movies together. We've been on a David Lynch kick around here lately, so we've just been keeping it.
What did you do for your 21st birthday?
You know what? I barely even remember what I did for it because I was living in Tallahassee at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I think I went to the movies with my girlfriend at the time. I think I also kept it pretty non-traditional.
Did you make out, or was it like some art house movie and you needed to focus?
I was 21. Of course I made out. We made out in every movie.
Of course 21. I made out. Of course I did.
Of course. I don't know. I really don't remember. Isn't that sad? I remember friends. You know, actually, I wasn't really an alcohol guy at 21. It took me a few years. It
took you a little longer, yeah. Because now you are, for sure.
I mean, now I enjoy a drink here and there. Yeah. But I wouldn't even say I'm a regular drinker either. You know, there's a bottle of bourbon in the cupboard at all.
Well, that's very Jewish, right?
It is, actually. My parents did not drink at all. My dad was a zero.
No, I was thinking the bourbon. Like, a lot of Jews drink bourbon for some reason, yeah.
I grew up a lot of teetotaling Jews, personally. I mean, not my generation, but all my parents and grandparents. I didn't really have any. The only drinker that preceded me was my grandfather, who died at 60 of like his fifth heart attack. So he really lived it out to the furthest.
He lived it to
the
max.
There.
I remember.
Yeah, definitely.
When I turned 21, I went to college like in the middle of nowhere, so you didn't really need like a fake ID situation because it was just basically dorm parties. But occasionally, like when I'd go to like Boston or New York. Occasionally try to like get into some, and they were very intense about IDs and it never worked. But it didn't happen enough in order to warrant getting a fake one. And when I turned 21, I went into Manhattan and with a couple of people, including one other friend who has the exact same birthday as me, like same date, same day, same year. And we went to this, and we pre-gamed somewhere, and then we went to this club, and they just waved us in. And I was like so ready to like slap down my license,
God
have my like my Joseph Campbell like initiation, and they were just like, "Yeah, go in, go ahead." And I was like, "What the hell?"
Yeah.
And also like, "What the hell? Why didn't I come to this? Why didn't I come to this club before? Like, you know, like what the?
Yes.
Yeah, it was very frustrating. It was almost like almost like the bouncer knew. Like he just literally like smirked and just was like, "Yep, come in."
That's yeah, right. It was more Joseph Campbell than you even expected because he just completely mindfucked you.
Yeah, he did. He totally like Obi-Wan'd me. So
when you do not want to drink, may you drink.
Right, exactly. So when you're out of town on these corporate gigs, what does that mean?
I'm doing a series of promotional videos for W Hotel, so they're doing little spots at different places. Going, we went to Miami Beach. We went to L.A.
Nice.
This weekend actually is here in New York. Then we're going to Chicago. So, yeah, it's good.
When are you going to be in Chicago?
I think in 3 weeks.
Okay, I'm going to be in Chicago in September myself. Maybe we'll.
Overlap. Oh yeah, what are you doing there?
I'm doing some Dope Boys stuff.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so we're both in a similar lark there. Do you want? Would you like a Peter Thiel voiceover for any of these?
I don't know.
Come to the W Hotel that's slightly less gross than the other places. Still, yeah. You'll probably die.
Yeah.
It'd be great if you could do like a taxonomy of like the different like room rates, and then Peter Thiel could tell you at what rate you will be killed to extract your blood, depending on what rooms you can afford.
4 pints to stay here, 50 pints to stay here.
What was the movie you recommended last time?
I believe last time I recommended, wait a second, see, because now I have my handy dandy chart. If everyone goes to imdb.com and does a search for Matthew Film Guy, they will find my exhaustive list of all the films that I've recommended on this spot. It was Punishment Park, the pseudo-documentary about the hippies who get sentenced to run through the desert being chased by the National Guard for their crimes against the state.
Oh, I do want to see that. I can't believe I haven't gotten to that yet. Was that one that we discovered? Was that like available on YouTube?
Yeah, I think it's a YouTuber because it came out on a Criterion DVD, but I don't think any... Actually, no, didn't somebody tell me that now all of Criterion DVDs are streaming at the library?
At the New York City Public Library. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah. That is a great place to find movies, including all probably most of the 74 or 5 that I've recommended up until now.
Is there any like director that have sort of, you know, Oscar buzz prestige in this sort of, you know, in the mainstream kind of white bread, middle brow way that you would sort of turn your nose up with your deep cinematic sophistication? Is there any of these people that you have that like you would give any props to?
No, I don't think so. Well, that's not totally true. I mean, it depends on what you're going for. You know,
a movie to me like Moonlight, like that to me, I was shocked by how good that was. Like, is there anything, because I don't have anywhere near your knowledge or sophistication, but I just have that general like, I don't really like that. That's boring. You know, like I'm just hypercritical. Look, so a lot of stuff I'm but Moonlight came along and I was like, wow, and it's not particularly sophisticated filmmaking. It's kind of like a play on screen, but it's very well written. It's incredibly well acted. And it was like, oh, okay, well, this is a movie that it was kind of like The Wire in the sense or The Sopranos. It was like, all right, sometimes things get traction in popular culture and they're actually really good.
Yeah, I actually haven't seen Moonlight yet. It's on my short list of recent movies to see, but I really loved the director's previous or his first film, Medicine for Melancholy, which I felt had the emotional sophistication of the kind of movie that, like what you would say, I give props to. You know, it doesn't need to be necessarily this sort of cutting edge visual aesthetic. That's not necessarily my bag.
Right.
I'm looking for your vision of the world, for your kind of conception of humanity? And is it something that kind of just flattering and easy to make everyone in the audience feel smart and cool and arty for absorbing and, oh, I'm sophisticated? Or is it something that's a little more challenging, a little more willing to, you know, implicate the audience and to require a little bit more from the viewer than just to kind of be spoon-fed a kind of a shorthand way of seeing your life? And I thought Medicine for Melancholy, even though it kind of fell into the mumblecore kind of rubric, had a lot of
I do not like that stuff.
Subtlety and had a lot of, I mean, I actually like a lot of that stuff, but only the ones that I think actually are, you know, using their kind of commercial alienation to the fullest extent and not just trying to do a kind of low budget version of Hollywood thinking, Hollywood movies, you know, that you can get a lot of that too at that level.
Right.
So I guess I can't really speak to Moonlight specifically, even though I'm definitely going to see it. And I'm glad that it was a movie made for like $1 million, which is like zero in Hollywood terms. And it won a very prestigious amongst that crowd award. So that's not peanuts. That's not nothing. You know, I consider that an achievement, even though it's true, as we say every year, the Oscars are just a trade show for the movie industry, you know. So
I can't remember the last time. I haven't looked at. I mean, I haven't watched an Oscars in ages. Matt, did you have something you wanted to add? Something?
Well, not really add. I wanted to change the subject entirely.
That's fine.
That's okay. I wanted to ask Matthew. We've got a break coming up this next week, and I don't watch a lot of film, but I wanted to watch some sort of historical. Like, I'm going to watch
Game of Thrones.
There Will Be Blood. Yeah, history.
Yeah, Game of Thrones.
You do like history, so you'll watch Game of Thrones.
Yeah, exactly. Like but like not sort of that sort of history, but American history. So closer to home. I was curious if you had any general thoughts on sort of film history or period pieces in general, and if you have any recommendations.
Well, it depends. I guess in addition,
19th century America.
19th century America. Well, I'm going to have to give that a thinker because there's nothing that comes right off the top of my head. I mean, what actually is interesting is since films themselves have been made since the early 20th century, you know, there's a lot of history captured even in the dramatic films that necessarily at the time weren't period pieces.
Right.
I don't know if you ever watched Meet John Doe. That's one of the ones I've recommended before. That I think that's an amazing movie about the kind of history of how fascism was understood in this country, and that was made in 1941. That's one I can recommend with no qualms whatsoever. Go back and look at my list because there's some other ones on there. It's maybe not American history, but The Grand Illusion by Jean Renoir about the POW, German POW camp with French soldiers captured. That's another amazing historical film that I think you would probably get some buzz off of from your history buzz side of your brain. I'll give that a think, man.
Matthew, can I? Because you know, we're going to get to your actual pick for a week in a second, and I hope it was specifically tailored for talking to me. But I am actually curious. I don't know how to phrase this question, but is there like, if there was a doorway into watching the kind of films that you recommend, that would be something that would sort of develop somebody's palate? What would that movie, or conversely, if there's like one movie that probably people have not seen, but you really wish that you could sort of like enlist like a Maoist force to force everybody to watch it, what would that
sit
movie
down
be?
In this chair,
yeah,
watch this
sit
movie.
Down. Film guy Matthew, he's a very nice Jewish boy. I'm going to give him LASIK so he doesn't get wiped out when we take over the fucking country. And you watch this movie. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Well, look, I can only really speak to my own kind of development as a film guy, and I know that there's been a lot of people who've taken a similar trail.
Right.
You know, for me, it started with a movie like Harold and Maude, which is one of those 70s Hollywood kind of anomalies that in that era was allowed to be made with somewhat of a bigger budget.
Okay, can you give me a detour for a second? Why do the 70s, clearly there was like genuinely good movies made in the Hollywood system.
Yeah,
why is that?
Well, it was a blip in the system. You know, the story basically goes, and if you read that book that we've talked about before, Easy Riders and their Raging Bulls, it goes on to talk about how by the end of the 60s, the counterculture, the baby boomers who had come up, were kind of enigmas to the powers that be, the old men trying to make money. And this was true in the music business, too. They were unclear as to where to go to kind of capture this audience. And they used examples of movies like Paint Your Wagon, which was like this Western musical, to just show how completely bonkers they had gone trying to kind of capture the popular sentiment. Right. And they turned to the first generation of film brats, these kids who had grown up kind of going to film school for the first time, really. And that was the 70s. They kind of handed the keys to Hollywood over to these kids in their 20s, which is, you know, your rogues gallery of big names. Coppola, Scorsese, Spielberg, Lucas, you know, and other guys like Hal Ashby, who made Harold and Maude, were allowed to do kind of things that you wouldn't have thought could have gotten by necessarily. They were highly influenced by the European cinema of the 50s and 60s, which had gotten a lot of acclaim worldwide. The French New Wave was a big influence on them, which came out of the 60s. And it just lasted from somewhere around the early 70s until the famous kind of mega flops of Gates of Heaven, which was Michael Cimino, who he made the Deer Hunter. There's a lot of these guys came out in that 70s era. And it was just like a perfect storm of actually artistically adventurous and kind of personal filmmaking meeting the commercial cinema.
And then in the 80s, it's almost like it parallels with Reagan. It just goes, it's just become like garbage.
Well, you
other
get,
than Eddie Murphy get, movies, because I like Eddie Murphy.
Right? All right, well, we'll get to that.
But no, it's just interesting that drop.
Jaws and Star Wars. Made them realize like, oh, whoa, we don't need to be trying so hard to make these movies. I mean, even if you look at the normal Hollywood movies of the 40s and 50s, they were emotionally complex. They were like mature adult stories to a certain extent. You know, movies like The Apartment with Jack Lemmon. That would be like a mumblecore movie today, basically.
Right.
You know, it's just not, there's no action. There's no, it's very kind of a day-to-day human drama, you know? So they realized in the 80s, they didn't have to try that hard to just make money. You know, they could just do special effects. They could do action adventure. They could do bigger spectacle. So the blockbuster mentality took over. And that's when you get also the kind of great American independent film movement in basically in the 80s and the 90s. And basically today, it's been almost completely wiped out. But in a way, it only its commercial viability is wiped out, because we have such an atomization of ways to see movies that there are those very low-budget movies you can get on iTunes that you never hear about because there's not enough money to spend on advertising. And then you just get Spider-Man movies and adventure movies.
Right. So there's no, it's kind of like everything else. There's no room for that sort of middle lane. All right. Well, Matthew,
that
parallels every, I mean, from the middle class to film production. So what
it really is, yeah. It really is.
So what are we watching this week? And I will watch some of these on vacation next week. I promise. I do watch your picks sometimes, and they're great.
That's great. That's great. Sometimes is better than no times.
Well, I think we all know who's no times, because
yeah, Sam is no times.
I'm having a dispute on Twitter about Jimmy Dore, so I don't have time.
That's much more important.
Do you see?
That's much more important.
Because someone with three followers told me that Social Security might be better off under Trump, and I'm going to argue with him for 45 minutes. God damn it.
I honestly think Sam and I have talked about this before, but the same thing about like eBay, I do the eBay thing to get that little buzz. Just that constant little dopamine feedback you get from checking your Twitter and your Facebook.
Yep.
That is a very potent drug. And
very.
I can admit to even having that. That's even interrupted the time I have or the patience I have to watch movies these days.
Right,
believe me, that's a disturbing prospect. So you have to really set some time aside to do these things. I think it's important.
Yeah.
I know sometimes I feel like the school marm tisking the kids, but I can tell you it goes for me too. You know, needing to have that kind of meditation time.
I think actually in an odd way, anything that is sort of prolonged focus is not meditation, but it almost is a meditative experience in the context of today's attention span.
It let's just say it touches on some of the same muscles in the brain, if you will. You know, and they're atrophying the more you're just like, what do you say now? What do you say now?
Yeah.
Ding, I got a new thing. You know?
Yeah, that's right. So I agree.
It's all right, problem. So with that in mind, I'm going to recommend a movie that is not necessarily difficult to pay attention to. It's actually kind of bewildering in a lot of ways, but it is, you asked for like, what is one of those movies that really kind of cracked my head open on this road to film guy Matthewdom?
Yes.
It was John Cassavetes, A Woman Under the Influence.
A Woman Under the Influence by John Cassavetes. Okay.
Now we can talk hours about John Cassavetes. Reading a book on him when I was 19 basically was a major fork in the road for me, not just as a film guy, but just as like a person, just kind of understanding what I want from life and what I want from art, basically. You know, up until then, movies I thought were just supposed to be cool and funny and like, you know, like serious and neat.
Right.
But I never actually thought they could be like life changing. And I know that's kind of an overused kind of word or phrase, but the kind of soul searing, like, oh my God, like they're exposing something about me that's embarrassing to me to see them doing.
Right.
You know, so this is one of the most personal films ever made in Hollywood. And it's an independent film. Cassavetes used money from the actors, which is Peter Falk, one of his frequent collaborators, or at least multiple time collaborators. And his wife, Jenna Rollins, the actress who he's made several films with. And this is kind of like the middle of his marriage trilogy. He did one called Minnie and Moskowitz, which is kind of about the falling in love, madcap kind of romance, even though in his own way it's dark and brooding and bizarre. And he did one called Faces, which was actually his second film, which is about a couple breaking up. But Woman Under the Influence is basically, on the surface, it's about Jenna Rollins' character, Mabel, who is kind of a, you know, you don't know if she's crazy or you don't know if she's just kind of eccentric. And it's basically a pseudo biography of Cassavetes and his inability to kind of deal with normality. And it has a lot, it got misunderstood as kind of a feminist movie, but Cassavetes was not interested in making political points. He was basically about these kind of, how should I say this? These kind of, you can't pin down his kind of imaginative stamp to the world. It's order disrupting. He's shocking in his behavior. And it got kind of painted with a broad brush as Mabel is this neglected, underappreciated housewife. But really, she's much more deep than that. She's kind of she's a whirling dervish in this family, and her only real desire is to be loved and to love her family. And I don't really want to say too much more than that about the plot because it kind of is unencapsulatable. Mm-hmm. But it is one of the most personal, embarrassing, kind of implicating yourself. If you can identify with Mabel. It's one of the most personal movies ever made. And it's sometimes it's infuriating. Sometimes, you know, she does things that you don't want her to do, so to speak. You know, it's kind of politically incorrect in some ways. You'll be tempted to want to project your own kind of feminist or kind of humanist intentions to the way she's treated by her husband.
I will tell you, Mabel was not politically correct. She was not. Yeah, she wasn't. We don't have time for it, folks. She's a whirling dervish.
In the best way. I hate that Donald Trump is taking over our use of the word politically incorrect as a pejorative, but this is a movie that goes beyond just not caring about other people's perceptions of a certain social group. It's I can only put it in the way of that it's an extremely personal movie.
Wow.
And personal truths are always the challenging of political or systemic truths.
Right. Well, and then how do we synchronize those? That's an interesting question. Film Guy Matthew, yes. I'll watch this. I'll watch the other ones. And I hope to see you soon. Thanks so much, man.
My pleasure, buddy. Take care. All right. Anytime.
Talk to you soon, brother. Okay, everybody, we have a song from Jimmy Reefer Cake. Is that correct, Matt? I'm going to give you a second. I'm going to call the phone's down. I'll just call in while you're looking for it. 646-257-3920. We have a couple pieces of sound. The IMs are on. I'm going to take a few phone calls, and we're actually going to be out of here by 2 today. So not the usual incredibly long fun half. There are brand new shows, I believe, every day next week.
Well, no public show Thursday.
No public show members Thursday. Only. So membership has its privileges. And then there's the Labor Day show, which I believe is a montage of different labor speeches and things that honor the, you know, obviously the essential contributions of labor unions and their contribution to the struggle for a better world. And tonight, catch us live streaming 6 p.m. The Michael Brooks Show. Subscribe to Majority Report on iTunes. Become a member of Majority Report today at majority.fm/become a member. Subscribe to Michael Brooks Show on iTunes. Go to Michael Brooks, patreon.com/TMBS. Use the Majority Report kickback page, Amazon, and Jet. Call. Lines are open. We're ready for you. The IMs are on. We'll see you in the fun half. And right now, what's the name of this Jimmy Reefer Cake selection?
That fascist named Fred.
All right, Jimmy. I'll see how long this lasts, buddy.
That fascist talks a lot about the white man's victimization and whatnot. The rally is pretty small. Fred says it's because white civilization's about to fall. Antifa found the place and they came up here to get in his face of that fascist named Fred. But nothing in the world could change the mind of that fascist named Fred. No, no. Nothing in the world could change the mind of that fascist named Fred. That fascist named Fred. Antifa hit him with a stick. They punched him in the face and they punched him right in the dick. The rally was pretty small, but the fights were so bloody that now it's getting the most attention of all. They thought Fred would end up a paraplegic, and now it looks like Fred will be dead. That fascist. And now they hold a rally waving signs and say Fred is dead. No, he's a martyr for the fascist because now poor Fred is dead. That fascist named Fred. From his nightmare, Fred woke up dead. It's just a story his mind made up. He's lonely, psychotic and mad. And he dreams of Antifa and how he wants to hurt them real bad. He grabs his gun, he thinks he's gonna need it. This time Fred hopes someone else will be dead. That crazy motherfucking fascist named Fred. Nothing in the world can change the mind of a fascist named Fred. Nothing in the world can change the mind of a fascist. Nothing in the world can change the mind of a fascist. Nothing in the world can change the mind of a fascist. Nothing in the world can change the mind of a fascist. Nothing in the world can change the mind of a fascist. Nothing in the world can change the mind of a fascist. That fascist named Fred.
Okay. Let me see.
So I think a cautionary tale against Antifa.
Sounds like a cautionary tale against Antifa. I guess a general call to oppose violence. I guess that's nice. Whatever.
I don't agree with the. I don't agree with the notion that that there was a, it was a small rally. I think there was a lot of people on that Friday night.
Yeah, that was a pretty big rally, and it was a pretty big thing for our country.
It was going to get attention regardless.
I think we're getting into a new sort of era of a different type of false equivalency, which, again, can oppose violence, but if you think there's any equivalent violence between a fascist and Antifa, whoosh, that's a problem. We're in the fun half now. Is that correct?
Let's go to Finnegan's Wake.
All right, let's go to Finnegan's Wake. We will be right back with the fun half. 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. IMs are on. See you on the flip side.
She said, no, no, no. No, 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 no. Things are looking bad.